I will read again two quotations from the Upanishad which I read in connection with the asanas, the postures last time. From the Tejo Bindu Upanishad, that should be known as posture in which one can meditate uninterruptedly or undisturbed on Brahman with ease and without fatigue. And from the Mandala Brahmana, being firm in the unshaken spiritual wisdom is posture, asana. So you will see that there is the psychological, I will go even further, what I would call a psycho-spiritual aspect to what appear to be just straightforward physical postures. Now the same with regard to pranayama, breathing. Again from the Tejo Bindu. The Tejo Bindu is ascribed to Shankara, but whether this is the great philosopher Shankara, of the 8th century of our own era, or another Shankara who belongs to the second millennium before Christ, is a little bit difficult to say. The evidence from the linguistic style and some of the intellectual constructions in it seem to indicate the later Shankara, the famous philosopher. That is called pranayama, in which there is the control of the modifications of the mind through the cognition of Brahman in all states of consciousness. That is pranayama. The avoidance of being impressed by the phenomenal world as if it were not the relative but is the absolute, is said to be expiration. The awareness, I am Brahman only, is inspiration. The constant retention of this awareness without any agitation is the retention or cessation of the breath, kumbhaka. See? So there is a very profound aspect to the external so-called breathing exercises. It's rather a pity that the word prana is so very much associated with breath. Of course it does mean breath, but it's one of the minor meanings. Prana is life, life energy, not just in the biological sense, but in the total sense. In the Chandogya Upanishad, you will find Brahman is prana. See, so, since Brahman presumably does not have a body like ours, obviously prana cannot mean just breath and breathing as we understand it. Brahman is prana. It's life energy in any and every sense of the term. And because with a human body, breathing is indispensable for the continuance of life, therefore the word prana has this strong association with breathing. Then in the Varaha Upanishad, which is an extremely important Upanishad for the yogi, we have this. Taking his stand on himself when Brahman is seen, rejecting everything caused by ignorance of the Atma, is expiration. Absorbing the wisdom of the scriptures is inspiration. And keeping oneself in the knowledge of Brahman is the retention of prana, as we commonly say, breath. So you see, these are the deeper psycho-spiritual associations, shall I say, with the purely physical breathing as such. Now, we must realize that through asana, the organism is so sensitized as to cease to be an obstacle to meditation. We all know from our own experience, when we start meditation, we suddenly feel little itches here, little rumblings in the stomach. We want to sneeze, we want to scratch, we want to do anything and everything but meditate. The body obtrudes itself. 15 million cells making up the body all shout out, "Listen to me, I want this, I want the other." So, asana enables you to realize that state bodily where the body no longer interferes with meditation. Pranayama has its Buddhistic counterpart, anapanasati, mindful breathing as it is called. And those of you who are serious in this would find it well worthwhile to study that particular discourse. It occurs in the Majjhima Nikaya, mindfulness in breathing. It's a long discourse, and at first reading it might put you off a little bit. But let the mind rest quietly upon what you're reading, and you will discover many wonderful things. In the Yoga Upanishads it is stated that when one is in real samadhi, the body is like a log and does not feel heat or cold, pleasure or pain. Also, that what we commonly call the mind is in the state of unmani. It has reached the amanaska state. See? Which means literally mindlessness. Now be very careful. We use this word meditation. But the real meditation begins when we are mindless. This doesn't mean that we have become vacuous or completely gone off our heads or something. It doesn't mean that. We shall try and see what all that means. Now, I mentioned when answering the questions that the unconscious, what we call the unconscious, is a vast storehouse of the mental impressions which have just sunk in, either repressed or just forgotten, the vasanas. When one is in real meditation, perfectly quiet, these vasanas deliver themselves up for sacrifice on the altar to be burnt up. This is how I put it. Now you think that out very carefully. There is no state of conflict. There is no struggle. You yourself are in the state of complete peace and poise, calm. And in that state, all these which are repressed or just lying at the bottom of the well, they come up and are burnt up. But the burnt up is not a destruction. It is a transformation of the dross into pure gold. No dross is burnt away here. Those vasanas are your own psychical constitution. You would not throw away a part of your body simply because it was a little bit ill. Amputations sometimes have to be made, true enough. But those are extreme cases. With the psyche, you cannot amputate it. You can only so understand and remain aware that this transmutation of the psychical stuff of your being takes place. Transmutation takes place. Now, in that state of quiet, when the body is like a log, and it does not feel heat or cold, pleasure or pain, you'll find that in the Nada Bindu Upanishad and several other Upanishads, you will find that that has also been stated in the Buddhist texts. If you want chapter and verse, the first volume of the Majjhima, page 296, you'll find it. You will also find it stated by Saint Teresa in her work, The Interior Castle, in the sixth chapter, which deals with the sixth mansions, as she calls them, the fourth section, the 17th paragraph, has it. In identical phraseology. It's a very interesting point. Now, when the body, the whole organism, the body-mind organism, is in this state of perfect quiet, perfect peace, it offers no obstruction to the functioning of transcendent energies through you, the living being. Your organism is the vehicle through which, if you're theistically minded, God functions. The incarnation of God in the person is the meaning of that. If you want to put aside the somewhat restrictive and limited theistic terminology, you are the unresisting instrument of transcendence itself. This, if you like, may be regarded, if it helps you at all, as the purpose of human existence in the world. So now, we come to this point in yoga. How does this take place? How does all this emerge in the life of ordinary mortal human beings like ourselves? That is, if we can stay the course and make the grade, so to say. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. One dies. You know, Patanjali starts with the statement, Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga, and it is unfortunately translated as, yoga is the suppression of the transformation of the mind. Now, I would put it this way, it is not the suppression. It is allowing yourself to be so clearly attentive and unreactively attentive that the responses of the mind to all stimuli are no disturbance whatsoever. Chitta, in this context particularly, means the flow of discursive thought. Discursive thinking. We must look at our own lives. All day long, either we are talking aloud or we are talking silently. What we call our minds are ceaselessly chattering monkeys. They never shut up. They are everlastingly talking. This is what we call thinking. But this hasn't anything to do with thought in the transcendent real sense. Thought, in that transcendent sense, is a word to express this mysterious creative energy, this creative power which produces the appearance that we call the universe. That is thought. We are nowhere near it. We haven't got an inkling of it. We cannot use our imagination. We cannot study. We cannot grasp as an external idea or fact to grasp by means of our ordinary intellectual and brain activity. We simply can't do it. All our ordinary intellectual activity is in terms of words. And this stream of words never stops. Examine yourself at any time you like and see if that stream of words will stop. It won't. It just goes on and on and on and on. Now, notice the nature of this stream. It begins because the attention is interested in this, that, or the other. It proceeds and it comes to an end. And this beginning, proceeding, and ending, this birth and death, goes on incessantly in your own consciousness from the time you are more or less born till the time you die. This is the real stream of samsara spoken of in the ancient teachings. This is the real cycle of births and deaths. Do remember, the spiritual teachers of the world were concerned with what happens to the mind. Their omniscience lay in this direction, that they knew all about the workings of the mind. And it was with the workings of the mind they were concerned. This is the real reincarnational series, which goes on in my own mind from the time I am born till the time I die. I am born through self-association with words and concepts in the immediate moment. It goes on for a time and it finishes and I am dead. And I immediately come to life again in consciousness whilst this organism is alive. If you can really penetrate into this, you will find much illumination. Now, yoga chitta vritti nirodha. This stream of words is associated with all kinds of worldly things which brings sorrow, pain, misery, anxiety, fear, conflict, and so on into our lives. We seek peace from it. How does that peace come about? And this is where we must go a little bit into the depths. And I'm going to do that in connection with the question asked here. There are two questions. Christianity, according to Aldous Huxley, is monotheistic, whereas Hinduism and yoga is monistic. Could you say a few words? Yoga is not monistic or monotheistic or anything like that. The actual living practice of yoga completely overleaps all these intellectual classifications and distinctions. It's perfectly easy to talk in terms of monotheism, polytheism, monism, and so forth. It's perfectly easy to do that. But this is just the stream of words again. Intellectual indulgence. And all too often it becomes intellectual debauchery. That is why the Buddha, for instance, particularly laid down, out with all that. It's quite useless. That won't bring about realization, the realization which is nirvana. See? So out with all that intellectual debauchery. In the ambivalent realm of mere scholarship, and please don't feel that I despise scholars, far from it. People accuse me of being a little bit of a scholar. But scholarship has its place. Scholarship is just a servant, it's a tool, nothing else. Don't let it dominate you. So we can neglect all that as far as yoga is concerned. Now, could you say a few words about Maya? And this is tied up with all this business about the stream of words and so on. Now, attend very carefully. The Upanishads made a statement which ordinary intellectual processes can never probe. They talked of Brahman or Atma as that from which speech and mind return not having attained. You can quite understand that speech and ordinary and all that is represented by speech processes cannot attain the transcendent. But the word mind is the stumbling block. Most people interpret the word mind in this context as meaning the process of discursive thinking. It has nothing to do with that. As the Buddha, you'll find it in the Buddhist texts. Discursive thinking is a speech activity. Quite rightly. It's only silent speech, that's all. This is discursive thinking. It's not that mind which is referred to here, but that other aspect which we might call the transcendent aspect of mind. What Buddhist terminology is called mind only, or pure mind, or something like that. That also returns not having attained Brahman. I don't think, well, I'll put it this way. I have never myself come across any writing or statement anywhere which clarifies this matter. I had to see it for myself. From which speech and mind, in its transcendent sense, return not having attained. That is Brahman. Now, the difficulty in talking about it is just this. I have separated speech, mind, Brahman. But they are not separate. They are all one. We, constituted as we are unable to communicate with each other without this analytical process of splitting up what is a whole. So, please keep that in mind very carefully. And do not think that we, from here, we go there, then we go there, and finally we attain Brahman. Nothing of the sort. It is all here, now, immediately, simultaneously. If you can really sense that, you will experience eternity. You will experience immortality. You will experience the process of the mind as it talks away silently without interfering with the one wholeness here now. Now, this state is the state of complete samadhi. The communion in which I no longer obtrude upon the universe, but am totally one with it, without knowing it with the brain. With the brain, I can only have discriminative consciousness. I, the subject, am observing that or you, the object or person. This vanishes, completely vanishes. This is not just Indian teaching. It is universal teaching. You read your Christian mystics, and they are the best example to give, because Christianity, more than any other, with the exception of Islam, completely separates God and man. Ruysbroeck, Eckhart, Dionysius the Areopagite. Read a good few of them and see what they said about this. So, in this state, you are not discriminatively conscious. You are not unconscious. You are, some people have used the term superconscious. I think it would be better if we use the term transconscious. Beyond consciousness, but consciousness is completely included in this. Transconscious. Now, the person in samadhi, sooner or later, usually they can stay in that state 7 days. The yogis talk about it, the Buddha talks about it, 7 days and nights he can stay in that state. Then the needs of the body demand that you come back to ordinary everyday consciousness, which is discriminative consciousness and analytical. So once again, everything appears to you as so many separate particulars. Now, in the process of coming back from that supreme state, as you become discriminatively conscious, you begin to split up the one into the multitude. The one becomes the many in your consciousness. Now, in what forms will this becoming many take? Obviously, the forms which belong to your race, your age, I mean not your physical age, the times in which you live, your cultural heritage, because there all the forms of expression are given to you. So back you come from the one state, heaven and earth are separated, emerge the angels and the different angelic and the demonic orders and all the rest of it, and all the whales and the dogs and the monkeys and the people and everything comes out. Back in discriminative consciousness. This is the creation of the world talked of in the scriptures. It has nothing to do with what our modern astrophysicists talk of when they present their cosmologies. Nothing to do with the physical universe at all. This creation of the world is your creation in your brain. You see? Now, all this is an appearance of the one and only reality, the one total reality, which is unknowable in terms of discriminative consciousness, unknowable by the intellect and the brain as an object of knowledge, quite unknowable. So when you return from that state to ordinary discriminative consciousness, you throw up this world, which you call the creation of the world. It is your creation. And it is an appearance of the reality. If your cultural heritage were different, if your capacities were to change because nature has taken another leap forward in evolution and produced a more sensitive and a more remarkable organism, you would not talk in the terms we humans have talked of, you'd talk in those new terms, if there was still talking left for those people. Now, this appearance of the one total reality, which you and I create, raise up in our minds, This appearance is Maya. I believe Shankara, I should beg his pardon, but he's dead long ago. I believe Shankara did not put it sufficiently clearly. When you read Shankara, you think that his statement is an absolute monism. There is only Brahman, the one reality, and all the rest is an illusion. No. Put it this way. There is the one total reality. The way my consciousness works discriminatively and throws up this whole creation of the world is an illusory presentation. It is not an illusion. You are not an illusion. I am not an illusion. We are all here. Our interpretations, our brain grasp of it is illusory. See? So now, Maya is the appearance. Maya also means that creative power by which the physical universe, what we call the physical universe, came into being. Now, this physical universe is a universe of energy exchanges, as the scientist quite rightly says. These are measurable. They are finite, they are measurable. Where mind only is concerned, it is not finite, it is immeasurable. When we use the word infinite, we immediately think of something immensely vast. Why? It is not merely the immeasurably vast, it is also the immeasurably small. Take the geometrical point. It has no length, no breadth, no depth. It is non-finite. It is infinite. You see? So mind only belongs to the infinite, the immeasurable, a totally new dimension of being and consciousness. And the Upanishad said that Brahman is that from which speech and this infinite mind return, not having attained. So you see, the transcendence is something which we can never grasp with the mind. But we can have a sense of transcendence emerge out of us. How and when? I talked about good sense through purification. When there is this purification, this discriminative consciousness itself begins to be aware of everything in a new way. In a wonderfully new way, it begins to be aware. This is the beginning of the emergence of the sense of transcendence in us. When that sense of transcendence begins to emerge, then it brings about most extraordinary changes on its own. How and why are they so extraordinary? Because I, the finite being, am at peace, am at rest, and I allow that infinite, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent energy to operate through me, provided I am purified. Hence the paramount necessity for purification. Only the purified being can do that. Now, the purified being is the real meaning of the word person. What we call personality is a mask. It's a distortion of the reality of the person. And the Upanishads, this occurs particularly in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the greatest and one of the oldest of the Upanishads, gives a wonderful presentation of it. Starts off by saying, in the beginning there was only Atma. in the form of a person, then it proceeds to explain, or rather pretends to explain, what is meant by person. It proceeds thus, looking around and seeing nothing other than himself, he said, I am. Now obviously, the statement, logically, is nonsensical. You must work that out for yourself. The Upanishad then goes on. Because formally, purva, formally, he burnt out, ush, the root is ush, he burnt out all papmanam, sinful mindedness, evil mindedness. Therefore, he is called Purusha, which is a person. Now you see, any scholar would just laugh that out of hand, and quite justifiably. But the Upanishads had their own curious way of just suggesting. The true meaning of person, therefore, is he in whom all evil-mindedness is utterly burnt out. That is the true person. Again, you see the paramount emphasis upon purity. Evil-mindedness is burnt out. Right. If then evil-mindedness is burnt out, that person can always be in the state of communion. The first four aspects of yoga, which are enumerated as such, yama, niyama, asana, and pranayama, are the preliminary preparation. Then comes pratyahara, as they call it, the withdrawal of the senses from sense objects. Again, the statement as it stands is ridiculous. You cannot withdraw the senses from sense objects as such. Wheresoever there are sense objects, they stimulate the senses, and an impression is made upon the brain. What pratyahara really means is that because you are free from evil mindedness, because you are pure inside your own self, there is neither attachment to nor aversion from the world of objects. That is pratyahara. Then it is possible to observe that other aspect of yoga, which is dharana, holding the consciousness of Brahman constantly. Again, the translation is ridiculous as it stands. How can you hold the consciousness of the totality? You are the finite. It is the infinite that holds you. You can't hold the infinite. Quite impossible. But it really means this. If you are the unresisting one, then that totality is everlastingly with you, in you, through you, with you. And that is the state of dharma. Then we have dhyana. Dhyana, attentiveness, is the best translation. Don't think of it as concentration and so forth. Attentiveness, dhyana. Now this dhyana is presented in the throughout the Upanishads in four aspects. The waking, the dreaming, the deep slumber state, and the transcendent state, the turiya, which is beyond all these. It is stated in the Maitri Upanishad that when you come to mindlessness, then you have gone back to the Atma. You have attained the supreme state. And this mindlessness is associated with the deep slumber state. This was a code used by all the Upanishads so that the wrong person wouldn't dabble with it anymore. You do not fall asleep when you are in communion. You are wide awake. You are all there. Continent, self-contained. And in that state, your mind is as free from disturbance with you consciously awake as it is free in the state of profound slumber when you are not conscious. That is why they use these terms. It must have been an extraordinary thing through the centuries for those people to discover this. Now, this is realized when we are awake through the observation, the pure observation of the flow of discursive thought and of the activity of our imagination during our everyday life from moment to moment. You just observe it. You are neither for it nor are you against it. You merely observe it. And if you can maintain that dispassionate observation, then you are no longer disturbed. When you are no longer disturbed, you will find this extraordinary transformation of awareness taking place. Even so, it is only the deep slumber state which is realized in full waking consciousness. Remember, in full waking consciousness, that deep slumber state is realized. There is that which is beyond that. If you are really interested, look in the Mandukya Upanishad. It's a very short one, only about 3 pages in print or so. Look in the Mandukya Upanishad. They talk about it. Talking about the untalkable, really. But nevertheless, one has to, if one is to communicate. And that Turiya state is that state of transcendence, wherein this organism, which belongs to the realm of energy exchanges, measurable energy, wherein pure mind, which is immeasurable, infinite, and this utter mystery, transcendence, is all at one in you, the living person. But the flow of words has completely stopped. And if the flow of words, of discursive thinking, of the pictures of imagination have completely stopped, then death is not there. Death as you and I know it. But what I call death, the other life, is there instead. What is the word? A noun or a verb? It represents the limited, the particular, the finite. If the stream of words which goes on unceasingly in our ordinary waking consciousness, whilst we are awake, stops, then in what manner are you aware of existence? Is it the manner of mortality? Or is it the manner of immortality? And this is the real, actual experiencing and realizing of immortality. Whoso has ever really attained samadhi remains like that constantly. Not in a particular state called samadhi, but this being who is utterly unresisting to transcendence is really transcendence embodied there. This is the ultimate samadhi of yoga. Ultimate is a bad word, but still we have to use all these words. All these words are inadequate in such a context. But nevertheless, that is there. So you see the importance of citta vritti nirodha. The fading away, the stopping of mortality and the emergence of the real immortality, which is the one total reality coming to full consciousness and fruition in you, the pure, perfected, Holy One, the human being. Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I will try and answer the questions which could not be answered last time because we hadn't enough time to go through all of them, but I'll complete all of them today. After I've answered the questions, we'll have a break, and then I shall round off or finish off what I started last time. The first question here is, how does one stop the mind wandering when trying to concentrate? You can't stop the mind wandering. Why not? Supposing there is some physical action you want to perform. You can think about it and decide whether you will do it or not do it, how you will do it, and so on. Take a very unpleasant, dramatic situation. You suddenly want to shoot somebody. You're angry with him. Well, you can take thought, and your good sense will triumph, let us hope, and there'll be no shooting. But consider the mind. The thought or the desire arises, and you are conscious of it after the event, not before the event. How do you stop that? It isn't possible. When the mind wanders, all you do is either to bring it back to the subject or the business on which you are concentrating because you have to, because you want to, or you follow just precisely where the mind is wandering. Pay attention to the other subject which has been taken up by the mind. Either way, there will come the point, the stage, when the tendency to wander will become less and less, and you will develop the faculty naturally to pay full attention to what you want to pay attention to or that which demands your attention. But in the ordinary way, you can't stop it wandering. Can you please say something about meditation, and when do you suggest is the best time for one to practice this? Since my talk after answering the questions will deal very considerably with the whole subject of meditation, I think I will be saying something about meditation then. I'll leave that aside, therefore, and merely say that the best time for one to practice this, of course, is when the spirit moves, when you feel the natural urge, and you are in form then, so to say, and you'll find it quite easy to meditate. What meditation is another matter. I don't know precisely what the questioner has in mind as regards the meaning of meditation, but we will go into that a little more during the talk. So the best time is when you really have the urge. Apart from that, if you wish to treat this as an imposed discipline, then you have to choose the time according to your convenience and according to circumstance. There is no escape from that. But if it is an imposed discipline, remember that is not meditation in the real sense. Most people find, certainly in countries like India, that the dawn, sunset, midday, midnight are the conventionally accepted best times for meditation. When I was a little boy and tried to meditate, I used to do it between 4:30 and 6 in the morning. Then I had to do my schoolwork and run off to school. But that time of the day is certainly quite extraordinary, especially when you are very young. You wake up refreshed, fit for the day. And of course, once you get into the routine, it is very helpful in many ways. That routine becomes not so easy as one grows older and older. But you must find which time suits you best. There's a wonderful saying of Krishnamurti, which I heard in the late 1920s from his own lips: do what makes you happy to do, and you will do right. One must bear in mind what he meant by happiness, not pleasure. Do what makes you happy to do, and you will do right. I know I have got common sense. Can you tell me how to get good sense? This is a most useful question. And I'm really grateful to the questioner for having put this. Good sense cannot be acquired. It is released from within oneself in the process of purification of the whole being. You may recall last time I spoke about the preliminaries of yoga, which are presented as the yamas and the niyamas. The word yama means control, forbearance, moral rule or duty. And I also suggested another meaning, which is not usually to be found in the Sanskrit dictionaries, namely mortification. And I explained what is meant by mortification last time. I'll repeat the list of yamas given. Harmlessness, truth, non-covetousness, continence, kindliness, equanimity, patient endurance, steadiness of mind in gain or loss, abstemiousness in eating and drinking, cleanliness of body and mind. And every one of these yamas has to be practiced in thought and feeling, in speech and in action. Which means with the whole of your psychophysical being, no part is left out. You, the whole existential person, the body-mind organism, must try to release these out of yourself. Consider the difficulties in the way. To what extent are we harmless, for instance, in everyday life? We may not actually strike a person, but we can say something that hurts. We can give a look that hurts. We may hurt as a sin of omission rather than commission. If a little child wants my attention and I do not give it, isn't that child hurt? Those things are reasonably easy to deal with. Reasonably easy. But consider the hurt which one causes throughout the day, every day of one's life, in one's feelings and one's thoughts. How many times, in agreement with the Red Queen, it is the Red Queen, isn't it? Who said, off with his head. But how often do we do that? Through the day. In our feelings. We are quite annoyed. We hear some news. And immediately there springs out a string of a whole torrent of inaudible chatter, which is not harmless as far as the other person or persons or situation are concerned. Terribly harmful all the time. And we actually do harm first and foremost to our own selves thereby. Every thought and feeling is associated with chemical reactions within the body. We all know so many diseases are caused by emotions and so forth. We all know that only too well. So we harm ourselves to start with. But let us not say that, oh well, that only concerns me, I don't harm others. Far from it. There is nothing whatsoever that I can feel and think, speak and do, but that it affects the total environment, the total situation. We have really to wake up to this and see the extraordinary responsibility that rests on our own shoulders. You can work the point out in greater detail for yourselves. Truth, I need not say anything about. Non-covetousness. Can the human race, driven by ambition, vanity, egoism, be free of jealousy, envy, and covetousness? See the consequences.